Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Another incredibly exciting, fabulous, miraculous, and various other amazingly long adjective show we have for you today, bro. Like, seriously. We have three guests on the line here right now for the duration of this 2 hours. I'm not sure if anybody else is going to call in, but I don't think it's necessary. We have Evelyn Gilbert from Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective. Evelyn, say hello.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
It's really nice too. And we also have Ben Vigen from Postman Productions with us as well. Good morning, Ben.
Good morning.
Yeah. And we also have Benita. I was going to say Benita like a banana, but it's actually Anita Bocchino. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Now, the context of this, and also probably mute your mics if you're typing in the background there. The context of this is that Anita sent an Official Information Act request to the Prime Minister's office, asking whether or not he has dual citizenship. And what's interesting about the reply here is not they said that they don't even have the information on that. So the Prime Minister's office apparently doesn't know if the Prime Minister is a citizen of the United States or not. So we're going to start off with Anita very quickly. Can you just tell us why you sent the Official Information Act request and precisely what they sent back to you?
I did it because I became very, very curious about John Key, particularly because he was spending all his holidays in Hawaii, meeting with Obama there on the golf courses. And we all know that when they meet together like that, we have no idea what deals they're making behind the scenes. So that sort of piqued my interest. And then thinking about all the time he spent in America, I began to wonder if, in fact, he was a dual citizen. So I sent off, I was very naive. I had never done it before. I sent off a letter to and got the response that you saw before you.
And do you have that in front of you? Would you be able to read it off for us?
I don't have it in front of me.
Okay, I think either Ben does.
Yeah, I think so. Just give me a second. Dear Mrs. Bocchino, Official Information Act request. Thank you for your email of the 27th of September 2014 requesting under the Official Information Act 1982, the Act, information about the Prime Minister, Right Honourable John Key. You have asked whether Key holds dual citizenship and is also a citizen of the United States of America. I am refusing your request under Section 18G of the Act on the basis the Ministry does not hold this information and we have no grounds for believing that the information is held by another department or minister in its / his or her official capacity.
And Evelyn, I was wondering if you've got something to weigh in here, or unless we want to go directly to Ben's analysis of this.
One thing is for sure, Anita, we requested this FOIA request, and I checked with the American Embassy, and there's a page on their website which states that it's perfectly okay for people from New Zealand to have dual citizenship. So it is possible. I heard from other people that you could not have dual citizenship when you were a United States citizen, but according to the United States Embassy's website in New Zealand, New Zealanders can have dual citizenship. Vinny.
And so that we're allowed to have dual citizenship with the United States. Now, I understand that in the United States, in order to become president, you have to be born in the United States and, of course, have U.S. citizenship. Is that the same case in New Zealand? You have to be like a New Zealand citizen and full stop, or you can't be prime minister?
No, I'll let you deal this one, Evelyn.
Ben, go ahead.
That used to be the case, but in 2003, the Labor government under Helen Clark retrospectively changed the law when their cabinet minister, Harry Donovan, turned out that he was actually also a Dutch citizen. So what they did was, to make it all okay, because Helen wanted to keep her seat and thus stay in power, they actually changed the law respectively. So right now, you can actually be a dual citizen and hold office in New Zealand as well. So you might be thinking, well, what's the issue then? The issue is when you actually look closer at the US law, it's that that catchphrase, which basically says, yes, you can be a dual citizen, but what you can't do is swear allegiance or be involved in a political office, which basically puts that allegiance above the United States of America. You would think being the Prime Minister of New Zealand would count as that category.
Unless, of course, you're somebody who accepts the reality that John Key's working for America.
Well, I mean, that's the whole point of the issue. Is it's like, well, if he's turning around and basically being the Prime Minister of New Zealand, which is, you know, you swear an oath to be the Prime Minister of New Zealand, which thus contravenes that part of the US law which says, no, you can't be in those circumstances dual citizenship, then he's either in a conflict of interest or he's breaking the US law. So it's one or the other. Mm. And that's the important part, why it's really important to actually answer this question about, you know, John, put your cards on the table. Where do your loyalties lie? When you go into treaties such as the Trans-Tasman Pacific Agreement, or whether or not we should see New Zealanders to fight in a US war, the war on ISIS, these are the things which the New Zealand public have a right to know about, you know, where your backers are and who you actually ally yourself with.
What is more is that when John Key was elected, rumor had it, I've never seen him say it or anything, that he was not going to accept the New Zealand salary that we were going to pay him for being our prime minister, which would be an indication that his loyalties lie elsewhere as well.
Yeah, but I guess I'm a little bit different on that one, even, because my attitude is I just see that as politics, because, you know, when you're earning massive amounts of money from Merrill Lynch, in terms of shareholdings, because you're driving New Zealand onto debt rocks, the money you're making from them versus what, you know, the pittance that you get as the New Zealand Prime Minister, it's like, it's a good PR trick.
Now, in terms of this, the conflict of interest element, can we even prove that he's a dual citizen or not without their admission?
Well, you know, short version is no, you can't. Okay, this is my understanding. I'm not a legal expert, but it's the issue of the privacy issue in terms of it needs to come from him to basically say, yeah, I actually am. So even if my understanding is that even if they forwarded it on to any of their relevant agencies, they would still have to forward it to John under the Act of Privacy Act to make him aware that this had actually been, you know, this had actually taken place. So we really are relying on John to tell us, you know, what the deal is. But it's pretty straightforward. Hold up your passport, show us, you know, what's actually in there, the paperwork, and we can move on. If you're not willing to answer that question in politics, my response feeling is politicians don't answer questions they don't like that'll make them look bad.
Now, Evelyn.
I just checked with my own embassy, because I'm a Dutch national, and if I want to renew my passport, I have to send in all my passports and all my IDs from other countries if I have a dual citizenship or triple citizenship. Because, well, if you're allowed to have dual citizenship and you acquire, say, for example, an Israeli citizenship, is that also still legal? But I would have to send my passport, my Dutch passport, my New Zealand passport, my Australian ID, all for the renewal of my one Dutch passport. I don't know if that's the same in New Zealand.
I don't know, but it's a very good question, Eva. You know, you would just simply assume. Sorry,
I think I can speak to that. It's Anita here. I am actually a dual citizen, dual American, New Zealand, and it's very simple procedure. I didn't have to send in any passports except my New Zealand passport to the New Zealand consulate, and then when I renewed my American one to the American consulate, it was simple, straightforward. I wasn't required to send any other passports.
Were you ever anywhere at any stage required to actually declare the fact that you're a dual passport owner?
I don't actually recall, but no, I don't recall. I just know that it was very straightforward. And
now, here's the other question. If this is so simple and so straightforward and so benign, why would the Prime Minister's office send back a denial that they have any of this information? And more to the point, yeah. Ben, you managed to analyse that they didn't actually just send it back directly from the Prime Minister's office. They actually got a solicitor to do it. So
just to correct it, Anita's official information act was sent in to the Ministry of Justice, and feel free to correct me, Anita. She originally approached the department and spoke with a bureaucrat, Tanya Warburton, the senior legal counsel, about what would be required to make an official information act. She didn't say exactly why, but she said, you know, made it clear about what her intentions were. Tanya sent her back advice. On that advice, she filed an official information act. The Ministry of Justice replied, saying, under Section G, we're not going to answer that because we have no reason to think that we have this information that anybody else would. And that's where the issue is, because in actual fact, when you file an Official Information Act, Section 13 of the Act makes it quite clear that if you don't have the answer, you forward it onto the relevant agencies that would have that answer. So in this case, the logical departments would be A, the Ministry of Immigration, B, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, which also handle passports, and C, the Prime Minister's Office, because, of course, John Key is the person in question, and it's a logical direction to forward it on to him. They're saying we're not going to do that because we don't think that John would have the answer. I mean, that's ridiculous.
Well, that's why I sent it on to you guys, because I didn't know where to go with it. I'm not a journalist. I'm just a citizen. And so I thought, no, this is not right. There's something going on here. And so I sent it to you two. And so, Vinny as well,
Go ahead, Evelyn.
Okay, can I add some information about Mrs. Warburton's CV?
No, you can't. You can't.
On D-Link, where she registered, she gives her public CV as follows. She worked for the Crown Council in Crown Law, and then in October 2012 until April 2013, she becomes the Acting Deputy Secretary of the Cabinet, the Cabinet's Office, the Department of the Prime Minister and Cabinet. And then she rises up in the ranks. April 2013... She becomes Acting Deputy Secretary of the Cabinet. After April 2013, she becomes the Acting Chief Legal Counsel. I'm reading this all wrong. She becomes a Deputy Chief Legal Counsel until January 2014, when she becomes, that is only the beginning of this year, she becomes the Acting Chief Legal Counsel. So she is very much connected to the Prime Ministerial Office.
Exactly. You know, and as I said, you know, this is a Information Act. I mean, I'll give you an example. I filed an Official Information Act about the role of a police officer involved in crime scenes, which basically looked like there was evidence being planted. I basically sent in my Official Information Act saying, you know, was he the officer of the crime scene in this case? They replied back to me, but they also made it clear that under the Privacy Act, they'd also made him aware that I'd filed this Official Information Act. So, you know, it's logical to simply forward this on to John Key.
Well, I would say that if Anita, when she filed it, under that same law, the privacy law, they would have had to notify John Key.
Exactly.
Mm. Now, the other element I actually wanted to do is actually read out Ben's piece here, explaining the whole thing. I don't know how long it would actually take me to read out if you're prepared to sit through it, but...
It's quite a long piece, so what I might suggest I do is actually read out the bits which I think are the bridge bits which are kind of maybe important to this situation.
Go for your life.
Okay, just bear with me a second, folks.
Because I think that it's quite interesting here, because I'm wondering exactly what would be the implication right? Because it's legal under New Zealand law for somebody to be a dual citizen, even a member of parliament, even the prime minister. And I'm aware that New Zealand parliamentarians, when they're sworn in, do not swear allegiance to New Zealand, nor the New Zealand public, nor New Zealand law. They swear allegiance only to the Queen and all her successors. And that's it. Period. End of story.
Doesn't matter. I mean, I see your point you're making, and it's quite amazing that we have in this time and age we do, but the very fact that she's swearing allegiance to the Queen, that's another entity. That goes against the very nature of when you are and are not allowed dual citizenship under US law. It's, the thing is, when you read up on it, it's something that they've allowed. They don't encourage it. And this is the one thing which they're really keen to basically, they don't want to have a person in a situation of influence that's actually turned around and said, well, I swear my allegiance to somebody else. And it's actually, from a political viewpoint, it's a very logical thing. But, at the end of the day, forget the law, forget all these aspects of it. It's a situation is, if John Key is a citizen of another country, New Zealand public have a right to know that, because when he goes into these deals with the TPPI or ISIS, we've got a right to know where his thinking lies. And, it's a very sensitive subject, but the issue also goes on the issue about John being basically of Judaic persuasion. I don't give a damn whether your head of state is Islamic, Christian, worships the Smurfs. That's not the point. It's disclosure. And if you're not disclosing that situation or excusing yourself in situations where there may potentially be a conflict of interest, you're not doing your job. And that's the real nuts and bolts of what's going on here.
What's more, with this last swearing in, John Key actually declare his allegiance to the Queen. He made a statement.
What was the statement? Do you recall?
Interesting.
Well, he didn't want to swear allegiance on the Bible, which is the more normal thing to do. So you make an affirmation, which has the same legal standing, but it is a departure of his previous declarations.
Well, it might have been, I speculate, because he didn't want to get a burn on his hand by touching a holy book. I joke. Ben, are you ready to read out the relevant sections of your analysis here?
Okay, well, we simply start off. Washington's man down under, a constitutional crisis. John Key, US lawbreaker, or John Key, New Zealand Prime Minister, USA spy. Evelyn Gilbert, Ben Vidgen. What would you say if it turned out you found the Prime Minister of New Zealand, our sworn head of state, which, as we've realised, he's actually done his affirmation instead, was in fact working for another nation, technically making him a traitor, the only law in New Zealand which still carries a death sentence? Rubbish, is what most Kiwis would reply. That couldn't happen, right? Perhaps, but the postman raises some interesting facts concerning John Key's citizenship. After one Kiwi's decision to do just that, ask, John, are you a Yank? Once she got her answer, she contacted Aotearoa Wider Perspective blogger Evelyn Gilbert, who in turn contacted me. But before we cover the contents, let's consider the ramifications, because if they are correct, it means John is at least guilty of a major conflict of interest on issues such as whether we should be supporting the US in offshore conflicts or whether the New Zealand should sign the USA's advocated Trans-Tasman Pacific Agreement, a treaty described as the most draconian act to face democracy in 30 years, a treaty the USA will go to any means to make sure we sign. As the most important piece of news to do these days, the relevant information came in an email sent to Anita Pacino, a New Zealand citizen born in America who was familiar with US law. She wondered what exactly was John Key's status as a Kiwi. She knew he'd spent considerable time living in the USA and still owns property there. So more out of curiosity, she filed an Official Information Act request to the Minister of Justice, then headed by Judith Collins, asking the simple question, is John an American citizen? It's an important question, as in the US you cannot hold dual citizen and hold position which pledges your allegiance to another nation or organisation. And that's the key word, allegiance. Meaning if John was both a Yank and as a Kiwi politician, he would be in an embarrassing situation of being both a foreign national of a country which prohibits by its own laws for you to hold oath or loyalty to another state while being the head of New Zealand and making key decisions on behalf of New Zealand. This would certainly represent a major conflict of interest considering the aforementioned issues of the TPPA and our role in the anti-ISIS war coalition. And as we know, Pacino got her answer and basically the answer is that we refuse to answer that question because we don't know anybody who would have the answer, although they could just go down the hall because we know that Tanya's got very close links to the Prime Minister's office and ask. But, you know, there were four points which we made up. The first point was basically knowing that Anita had already contacted the ministry seeking advice, so they knew what her legal understanding was when they made the reply. The second point was, as I said, was this actually contravenes 13 section, which very basically states that, you know, if you don't know the answer, it's your job to go and find out someone who does know the answer, not, oh, we have no idea. You know, Ms. Warburton's the chief legal counsel, citing Section G, in fact, does not apply in this case. To cite it accordingly is a misuse of the statutes, and the appropriate action is now to take this up with the New Zealand Ombudsman so as to force an answer out of the government to a very important question.
You know what this makes? It just really makes me want to get myself a black Gestapo uniform and go up to John Key and ask for his papers.
Well, you know, they want to bring a national identity card here, so if it's good for us, you know, why is it wouldn't be good for us to know who our head of state, what his nationalities and what papers he signed up with? It's a really, you know, it shouldn't be this hard to get this answer. And it's a really simple question, and it's a question which actually deserves answer. And if he's not going to answer it, you know, that itself, it's not so much what they answer here, it's how they've gone about answering. That really is the telling sign.
It sends up a bigger red flag than the entirety of communist China.
Exactly. I mean, you know, if I'd been the Prime Minister, I mean, I would have turned around and said, okay, actually, I am a New Zealand citizen. I don't hold citizenship of the United States. Here's the documentation to show it. Or actually, I do. So what? Plenty of other people do. In fact, there's a lot of people in New Zealand Parliament that actually also hold dual citizenship. You know, and it really does bring a question because in most countries around the world, you know, there are two things you don't do. Is you don't have foreign nationals in your government and you don't have foreign nationals in your intelligence service. But in New Zealand, we actually have, you know, plenty of US citizens in our work in our intelligence services.
Oh, and indeed, the National Security Agency has an office in the GCSB building.
Well, and I do.
I was thinking about an Aretha Franklin song, John Key, GCSB, find out what it means to me. Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead, Ben.
Let's take this a step further and go down the worst case scenario. Let's turn around and say that John Key turns out that he is actually a dual citizen of another country, one which says that you can't do it unless you're swearing allegiance to that country above and beyond your oath to your own country. In other words, you're putting the US as being more important than being the Prime Minister of New Zealand. Now, in that case, here's the ramifications. First of all, John Key would actually have to step down, which would mean that you've just lost the seat in the section, which means you no longer actually have a majority government. Secondly, this would also call into question the Minister of Internal Affairs, which was Peter Dunne, who basically, it's his job to know this, and if he's choosing to turn a blind eye to it, then that's his seat rolled as well. So that's two seats in the government that you just lost. So then the next step is to turn around and call on the Governor-General. But unfortunately, our Governor-General is the former Minister of the GCSB, a former military officer, which again, the GCSB, you know, the senior officers in that are officers of the US spy agency, the National Security Agency, who as of 2007 now define who and who is not as a terrorism. Our entire legal and constitutional processes have just been circumnavigated by this whole series of conflict of interest. We've actually got this. What the real issue is, this points to a constitutional crisis.
Can I add something to that? I would like to point out that with John Key, at the time David Shearer, Russell Norman, Fletcher, his first name escapes me, who now runs the GCSB, as well as Graham Wheeler, who lived in the United States and was the second in command in the World Bank, the five most powerful positions in this country have all been taken by people who either made their career outside of New Zealand, and for all we know, Ian Fletcher may very well have dual British New Zealand citizenship, which means that all their loyalties are more globalist than they are New Zealand.
Now, I will have to just stop us just there. We're coming to a break. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. This is a listener-supported broadcast, so if you wish for independent broadcastings who happen in New Zealand and let's face it, there really isn't much other choice out there other than this show. Please go to the homepage, thevinnyeastwoodshow.com, and either donate or once off or start a subscription for about $5 a month or less or more today. And if you don't want to get nothing back for your money other than a broadcasting station that works tirelessly to expose a bit of scumbaggery and give the activists who are actually telling the truth that the mainstream media won't actually touch with a 10-foot barge pole or something even more sexual, you can go to the sponsors that we have there, Volcania International Coffee and the High Tea Cafe in New Lynn, which, by the way, has just been raided unlawfully, mind you. They did so without a warrant, even though it was a private residence. So I want you to see if you can help support Jeanette Saxby there. And also Blue Shield, protecting yourself from EMF and EMR wireless radiation by a few little devices there. We will be right back after the break. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting on thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. That's Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, obviously, and Eastwood isn't go ahead, make my news. And we will, and we are. Now, my very special guests are the person who sent the Official Information Act request to the Justice Department, then headed by the no longer honourable Judith Collins. In fact, scarcely think she was technically honourable in the first place, but Anita Bocchino, and we also have from Postman Productions and the Postman Show, Ben Virgin, as well as the blogger extraordinaire, Evelyn Gilbert, from Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective. Now, Ben, are you able to continue on getting through the points in your piece there?
Well, basically, we've actually covered the main areas, but there's just two things which I want to cover, which is the last one is the fact that when you go to my Facebook page, www.facebook.com/postmaninvestigates, or you go to Evelyn's blog, Aotearoa, A Wider Perspective, we are suggesting that people cut and paste our Official Information Act request, which we've said we suggest should be sent off to not one but three different agencies, Justice Department, Internal Affairs, Immigration, and in fact, if you want to do it, the Prime Minister's Office as well. And what we're also suggesting you do is that you cut and paste the letter that we've sent to the Ombudsman's Office, basically saying, well, you know, this section wasn't answered according to Section 13 of the law. We not only require but demand an answer, which is what we're entitled to do. The second point, I want to go back to something we said before in the show, which is, you know, I've been thinking about this, and that to turn around and suggest that we have plants in our government is, oh, no, it's conspiracy theory stuff. Well, let's go back to WikiLeaks, because WikiLeaks actually is the US government's own cables. Those cables make it quite clear that that the US does actually have offices planted in our own Defense Department. Now, in comparison, if we looked at the William Such affair of the 1970s, lots of allegations were being made out that William Such, who was then a bureaucrat working for the New Zealand government, was a spy of the Soviets. And there's been tens of thousands of lines written about this, books, articles, documents about asking the question about whether or not William Such was a spy. The best they've ever managed to come up with is dodgy documentation that doesn't mention his name, that came from a defector desperately wanting to get into the US, and that's the best they've managed to come up with in 35 years. Well, we've got documentation within the last year and a half on WikiLeaks saying that we do actually have these people within our office, so maybe we should actually be actually asking these questions and treating them seriously, because as it was made out by Bruce Ansley in his book, Stoned on Justice, corruption only occurs when you perceive that corruption cannot occur and you cease to look for it, you create an environment in which it thrives.
Kind of like somebody eating really, really bad food, not believing that they could ever possibly become unhealthy.
Look, I mean, you know, again, going back to why I think ombudsman's were actually worth following up with, is that the chief ombudsman recently just made it clear how angry she was with this government, because it turns out that via Official Information Act, that it turns out that it can now be revealed that we've got senior bureaucrats that have actually left office in New Zealand because they've been told by this government to cover up stories which are embarrassing to them. And this includes a senior lawyer working for the New Zealand Customs. You know, so you've got the chief ombudsman saying this corruption is going actually on, What more of a source do you actually want? What's shame is that that story was actually broken on the eve of the election, even though that the New Zealand Herald sat on that story for 6 weeks.
What is more is that, of course, Snowden has now revealed that New Zealand is being used, and New Zealand embassies around the globe are being used to spy on friendly nations, and on nations that might be hostile, but especially friendly nations. So it would be ridiculous to assume that we wouldn't be spied on or manipulated by international interests.
The naivete of the New Zealand government, I am pretty sure that it's been instilled very slowly but surely over time by very lax media reporting, to the point where basically this is all just fluffy bunnies and soft kittens, and that's the only thing that exists, and every single person in a position of power and extraordinary wealth with massive connections obviously can't be a criminal, psychopathic scumbag or a spy or anything like that, and in fact are only ever operating under purely altruistic reasons for the good of the country.
The documentation is in the 1980s, the file, the New Zealand GEMSO files, stated that we had New Zealand politicians that were on the payroll of basically Western or US oil-based companies and US governments. This same allegation, which was laughed at back then, was brought up during the Winebox inquiry. And during the Winebox inquiry, I wrote my book, State Secrets, and in that I turned around and I showed the allegation was made that there was also arms for butter deals made. I went through my first book, State Secrets, and I showed that, yes, you could actually show that there were arms deals being made in New Zealand. And guess what? There were New Zealand politicians involved in these companies, and guess what? These companies also involved members of criminal fraternities. We have seen, and this was the late 90s, we've seen since then nearly half a dozen different ministers have turned up in relation to either bribery or they're on the take, and this includes having accounts and dodgy tax havens. There's plenty of evidence out there. If you actually go and look at the evidence instead of making opinions, to show that, guess what, our politicians are as corrupt as anyone else's, and we should be taking this seriously, and this is why this question is important and why Kiwis have a right to ask it and not to be treated silly for asking it, and why they have a right to get an answer.
Now, that's a very important thing, and of course, again, I just want to reiterate this. If you ask a politician a very simple question, and they don't answer it very simply and straightforwardly, then there's something going on. Don't know what it is, but they're trying to conceal whatever it is, and that is a reason to raise suspicion. And I think that we've become, as a nation, very, very unsuspicious. And there's an old saying, a suspicious mind is a healthy mind. And I believe our nation has become mentally unhealthy.
Oh, totally. I mean, you know, I look at this in the context of one of my jobs in a previous lifetime was I was an intelligence clerk in counterintelligence as part of the territorials, what the United States would call National Service. One of my jobs was to vet people, to look for potential people that were trying to infiltrate the system. And this is why we look at documentation, passports, allegiance, political systems. It's pretty straightforward. And I'm applying that same criteria to John Key here. And the reasons are just the same. We need to know these things about what citizenship you are, where you own your property, which companies you got shares in. They all tell us about who is working for us, or is John working for us, or working for Merrill Lynch?
Ben, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Evidence aside, do you have a theory of what's going on here?
I have, in this case, an outright conspiracy theory. Which the difference is between everything else I've said beforehand is that's journalism. These are the facts. Let them speak for themselves. This is my own personal opinion, so it's theory, and I differentiate that very clearly. My theory is that from the 1970s onwards, for want of a better word, the 1% realised that New Zealand had lots of natural mineral resources and lots of good things that they wanted. And they basically set about, since the 1970s, dismantling this country, putting their own people in public office, in ministries, in banking, in journalism, to make sure that this country doesn't perform so that they can come in here and actually put us into debt and buy that debt, make us slaves, and subsequently invade us without even having to fire one shot. You know, we're facing occupation, and just because you can't see the tanks on the beach doesn't mean that it's not happening.
I don't think it's limited to the United to New Zealand. I think the same thing happened in the United States. There is a deep politics group that has basically committed a coup, and I would say round about the time John F. Kennedy was killed.
Bear in mind, ladies and gentlemen, John F. Kennedy was assassinated, I think maybe a week or two after he passed presidential directives 11111 and 11110, abolishing the CIA and the private Federal Reserve Bank.
Let's bring it down to something even more.
So I think it's happening there. I think it has happened in Canada. I think it has happened in Australia. So we're talking about the Anglo-Saxon Empire. What is also evident is that while the United States has a little bit of a different role in the constellation of the Five Eye countries, they are the military might of a group that basically we don't know who they are. And so I think that is very evident that since the United States went off the gold standards and the death of JFK, that we are slowly but surely being taken over by a small group of very powerful behind-the-scenes financial people.
I'm just going to say it. It's the new world order. It's the one world government, the one world surveillance grid, one world religion, and one world administration. And that's basically what's going on here as far as I'm concerned. And that's just based upon analysis of how every single Western government does the exact same things to their citizens, but they don't do it all at the same time so that every single citizen globally suddenly realize they're all being screwed simultaneously. They screw you one by one by one, tighter and tighter and tighter. And by the time people wake, and the whole idea behind this is by the time people realize that there's something up, they will already be trapped in a cage permanently.
Well, let's bring this down to something more basic, and I'll bring this back to the TTIP or the TTIP, depending on what alphabet.
It's the TPPA, all right? So if you drink tea, you need to take a PPA, all right?
Okay, what I was going to basically say is it's really quite basic. I mean, you can put any label you actually want to call on it. You know, it doesn't. I try not to go down that road. The reality is, in the late 1980s, 90% of the world's population was in the hands of 10% of the world's wealthy. By the early 2000s, that had transferred to 95% of the world's wealth was in the hands of 5% of the world's wealthy. Today, we're looking at 90% of that wealth is in the hands of 1% of the world's population. Of that 1%, 40% of their pie is controlled by less than 200 individuals. Those facts speak for themselves. We are completely right to assume that there is an all-powerful entity that is taking over and turning us into prisoners. The basic laws of economics are telling us that. You know, so you can call it the Illuminati or the space vampires or the New World Order or whatever you want to call it. It's very quite straight and quite simple. The few are ruling the many, and they're getting better and better at doing it.
And I don't even, it's not my term, the New World Order, it's the elite's term. And there's a great film called, I think, Fabled Enemies, made by Jason Burmes, the maker of Loose Change. And in the beginning of this, for a half hour, it's nothing but recording after recording after recording of top US statesmen and officials using the words New World Order. It's not our term. It's not a conspiracy theory. This is their word. This is their term. This is their idea. And it's very, very well admitted. It's no longer a conspiracy if people admit that it's fully going on. And I believe Ian Wishart, in his book Totalitarian, has in fact defined this very, very well as being a convergence theory. That means it's totally out in the open. Anybody can go and look at precisely what's planned and what's going on for themselves if they wish to. Nothing's really secret in that respect. But however, people aren't all in on it. It's much like a shark feeding frenzy. Each and every shark has its own objectives, its own agenda. However, they all share the same target, you.
Yeah. I once had a chance to speak to a very high-level senior banker, and we're having a few drinks, and we had a bit of a a social connection. And I turned around to this guy and said, jokingly, and said, you know, guys like you, you just want to take over the world and, you know, have it all, don't you? And he turned around to me and, you know, he made a real point to look around the room to make sure that no one else was within earshot. He turned around to me, grinning very madly, he turned around to me and said, you're right, and there's nothing that people like you can do about it. You know, and that was, for me, was a real eye-opener, because, I mean, it's not the first time that I've heard that. From being in a position, whether it's at waiting tables in private dining rooms or talking to people like this, or even just, you know, being on the peripheral as a journalist and hearing some of the conversations that these people actually have amongst themselves, I don't think people really appreciate the world in which these people live in their mindset.
Well, it's a peripheral thing, and people have forgotten the advent of hubris, all right? And if you look at history and you look at it objectively, you'll see it's basically a long story of ruthless criminal scumbags who don't really give a frack about anybody trying to basically manipulate the masses into supporting them so that they can destroy and control their lives. And that's basically end over end, again and again. As Mark Twain said, history does not repeat itself, but it sure does rhyme.
Well, it surely does, and I mean, this is what we've witnessed for the last 20 years economically, is every time there's a crash, what actually happens? But the people that caused the crash, the bankers, they get wealthier, and we get poorer. And it's the same thing happening, but, you know, how many bankers have you seen rounded up and arrested? How many? I mean, in New Zealand, you know, think hard about this. You go back 30 years ago, and you think about when something happened, when a bureaucrat was held accountable, when a minister was held accountable. When was the last time you saw anybody in this country in any position of authority really having to pay for their actions?
Okay, so can I interrupt here? What I found very interesting is when I started to go back to the French Revolution, and we have more or less the same circumstances as what facilitated the French Revolution. Our leaders are waging wars, bankrupting not just France but the entire globe. We have an incredible inequality of wealth, where 85 people control 50% of the global assets. And we have an incredible disconnect between that elite and the rest of us. And we have very little say, indeed, in what is happening. So what happened when the French Revolution happened was that at the time, I think about something like 3,500 top bankers were decapitated with the guillotine. The French, and you don't see this very often in when you go back, but Max Kaiser and a French journalist made a little film, a half an hour documentary about this. And 3,500, if not more, top bankers were all guillotined. A lot of people who were working for the tax services were killed in the most atrocious ways. Tens of thousands of people who were helping the ancien regime finance itself. So, you know, it may not be that we now arrest these bankers, but, you know, history has shown us that when revolutions happen, it very often is bankers who are the target of the anger of local populations.
Now, I want to also mention, and I've just been in the background here doing a quick Google, because I recall that there were a large quantity of very high-level bankers who have died in the last few years. And if you search top bankers killed suicide, you'll have headlines coming out, 48 suspicious banking deaths. Four prominent bankers found dead within 6 days of each other, all ruled suicides, and the list goes on and on and on. Now, what occurs to me is that they're trying to tie up loose ends. I mean, that's basically what my conspiratorial mind says. If you've got people that are in the know, in the positions, and they're all dying, and in one case, a banker was actually, he committed suicide with a nail gun. And shot himself 6 times in the left side of his head and 6 times in the right side of his head, and then it was ruled a suicide. Okay?
Well, at least he got the point.
Well,
he totally nailed it.
I'm just going to concede, because of course the other thing that's happened today, which all ties in with us, is that we had the ruling basically on South Canary Finance, which is basically where a $700 million asset got sold off to the New Zealand government for cheap when it could have been saved. Only one person has actually taken the rap for that. And at the same time, we see that there were documents, missing documents and vital witnesses that the state chose simply not to actually witness. This is part of the whole package, is that, you know, it ties in with John Key, Merrill Lynch, and its links to Stephen Jennings of Renaissance Bank. We have a whole package of these banks creating debt cycles, which then force our institutions to collapse, put us in debt. We actually pay for it. They get wealthier, and then they utilize it to have greater control of our power state.
The other element here is, I mean, this is even mainstream. I got here is Wall Street killing its bankers, and that's an article from Bloomberg.
Yeah, no, you're talking, you know, we've had cases in Australia with the guy that got chopped up by the chainsaw that was into the sexual games. It was one of John Key's friends. We had the guy that was found wandering around in a park in Auckland for 3 days. Turns out that
he was actually a Ross. Was he a Rothschild?
No, he was a Rockefeller.
Rockefeller, yeah.
In the last three years
before that, hundreds of bankers and high finance specialists left banking. Including the managing director of Goldman Sachs
and Deutsche Bank and all the exactly. top bankers basically left. There was in total, I think it was over 500 major players in the world banking industry who quit their jobs.
Yeah, well, you probably find it's just like the Enron situation where a lot of these guys bailed before the ship went down. They got out with very good packages. You saw that even in South Canary Finance was. You know, everyone talks about Alan Hubbard. No one ever talks about Humphrey Wollaston, who at the same time pulled out, he involved these companies for 40 years, huge involvement, and then overnight pulls out all these companies, 100% of his shares, along with Hubbard. This is what you see all time and time again, these people actually pulling out before it actually collapses. And again, this goes back to these issues of when you go to someone like John Key or any office, you want to say, hey, look, we want this investigated. We want some accountability. We want some questions answered. If you've got their own person conducting the investigation, well, that's not going to happen. And this is what we've seen during the whole GCSB. You know, John was caught on television. He was caught on documents twice, lying about what briefings he had and had not given. And then what he did was he had an inquiry and he brought in the people that he had put there in power in the first place to investigate himself. And gosh darn it, they rubber stamped and said no wrongdoing.
Yeah, I think it was the Auditor General said they were asked about derivatives. I think it was in terms of financial instruments, and the Auditor General said, well, it's such a technical and complicated area that I can't understand it, so I got KPMG to investigate themselves for me, and they assure me it's all good, bro.
Yeah, well, that's what they did with Enron, and we saw what happened with Enron. And, of course, you know, that derivative is exactly the same situation. It's the same thing that's popping up Fonterra.
By the way, John Key is always pretending that when he was banking, it was all different. When they were asking him on Breakfast TV how could he have foreseen all this? And he said, yeah, actually, you could, really easy. So what happened with Merrill Lynch was, at the time, John Key was still working for Merrill Lynch when Enron collapsed. Three of his colleagues in the management department actually got arrested and put in jail for their part in the fraud of Enron.
Yeah, entirely. And it's the same situation in New Zealand. I did this in 1999 and others have as well. But for 15 years, I've turned around and said New Zealand has a money laundering problem and that the people in power are choosing not to enforce laws or letting loopholes exist. You know, for 15 years, everybody, all my colleagues said, no, that's not happening. That doesn't occur. Well, we now know today that there's and this is just one case that we know of, over $621 million laundered for New Zealand arms deals. You know, and this takes an offshore media to report this. In fact, everybody in the Western world who has any knowing about economics knows what a cowboy situation New Zealand runs, except for New Zealand we pretend, it's all we box like Oxford.
We're more or less the Cayman Islands of the South Pacific, I've heard some people say.
Oh, I like to call us the biggest washing machine in the South Pacific.
Well, and with the new Tito systems in Sky City Casino, where you put ticket in and ticket out systems, you can launder unlimited drug money, or any money for that matter, without consequence or the possibility of being caught. And activist Penny Bright pointed this out to the Auditor General and a number of top-level officials for whom it's their responsibility to tackle money laundering in New Zealand, and they said, nah, she's all good.
Well, it's the same for the institution. You meant to declare, if any house is bought in cash, realtors are meant to declare those to the authorities. There hasn't been one case that has ever occurred.
Namely because they take a commission on the sales of those houses and they don't want to give it all up. Unfortunately, Ben, we've come to the edge of the break now. I want you to continue on that point after we...
I'm actually going to have to bail on you guys because I've got other comments, so I'm going to leave you in the capable hands of Evelyn. And maybe we need to...
I'll tell you what then, just finish your point. Just finish your point and then we'll go to break.
It's pretty straightforward. All people need to do is be able to ask questions and get answers. And if they won't give you the answers and they try to avoid those answers, then you've got to ask yourself why that is.
Thank you, Ben, and thank you, Anita Burkino and Evelyn Gilbert. Ladies and gentlemen, you are listening to The Vinnie Eastwood Show on thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. It's a listener-supported broadcast, so if you wish to go to the homepage, thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. It's Vinnie with a Y because it's the most important question, and Eastwood as in go ahead, make my news, and go ahead, make a donation or start up a subscription for $5 a month today. We'll be right back. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on the... It's actually not live, it's pre-recorded. Let's not dick you around here. It's thevinnieeastwoodshow.com, Vinnie with a Y, because it's the most important question, and Eastwood isn't go ahead and make my news. And if you want to keep continuing to have that news made, please go to the homepage and make a donation or start up a subscription for as little as $5 a month in order to just keep the wheels running and just... You know, basically, I volunteer and help all the activists all over the world as much as I can with any time that I have available. And all I need is basically a roof over my head, internet, gas in my car, and food in my belly to do so. And I will do it. And I have been for many, many years. My very special guest joining me now is Professor James Fetzer. Jim, welcome to the program.
Oh, Vinny. Great. Glad to be here. Welcome.
Can you give us a little bit of a update? Because I haven't spoken to you in a wee while, because there was a recent leak, I think, from WikiLeaks or Snowden or something, confirming what you've been saying for a number of years, that there were mini or micro nukes used in the destruction of the World Trade Center.
Well, yes, I'm delighted to hear that. Veterans Today is publishing the most recent articles on this subject, but I have 10 articles probably laying out the evidence. It's ironic, Vinny, because we have one of the most important sources of proof is from the U.S. Geological Survey's study of dust samples, which were far more varied and extensive than those that were relied upon by Stephen Jones, Kevin Ryan, Niels Harrod, and others to maintain that nanothermite had been responsible for the destruction of the towers. It appears that even if nanothermite had been used, and it doesn't have the explosive capacity to blow those buildings apart to convert them into millions of cubic yards of very fine dust, or to destroy them to or even below ground level, that it was done using a sophisticated arrangement of mini or micro nukes, which, just to offer one model, could have been so arranged where you can dial their radius to, say, 100 feet. The buildings were 200 feet on and 8 feet on a side. If you locate them in the core columns in the center of the building, then they would have had a perfect opportunity, especially directed upward, to take out, for example, as an illustration, one 10-floor cube per second, so that in the case of the 110-story North Tower, if you begin in succession from the top, you'll blow the entire building apart in 11 seconds. With regard to the second, because the top three floors, three cubes were tilted to the side and blown as one, that would have taken 9. That happens to correspond to the NIST's time estimates. But the fact of the matter is, Vinny, that they hung their hook on a collapse, which wasn't even physically possible. Given the design of the towers and the laws of physics, those buildings could not have collapsed. And had they collapsed, I mean, Building 7 actually did undergo a collapse, then we would have had a pile of debris equal to about 12% of the height of the original. In that case, it was 47 floors. it yielded a debris pile equal to about 5.5. In the case of the Twin Towers, it would have been on the order of 13 or more floors of debris, but nothing was there, Vinny. This is a very powerful evidence. USGS dust samples include barium and strontium, lithium, lanthanum, uranium. Tritium was found there as well. Among the very first studies that I published about this was based upon the Vancouver hearings held in June of 2012. It's entitled 9/11 Truth Will Out, the Vancouver Hearings 2, and you can find it online. But since then, we've had a succession of additional studies that corroborated, including evidence from a Russian intel dump that Gordon Duff, the senior editor of Veterans Today, has been publishing in his own columns.
And what's the actual significance of this? Because a whole lot of people in the movement have been like, oh, 9/11's been, it's done and dusted. And I think what Bill Hicks would say, well, then don't bring up Jesus to me, you know, as long as we're talking shelf life here.
Well, just to make the obvious point, the 19 Islamic fundamentalists who are hijacking these commercial carriers, according to the official myth of 9/11, couldn't possibly have arranged for mini or micro nukes to be distributed throughout the building. That require prior planning, the access to the buildings. The Twin Towers, along with the rest of the World Trade Center, only went into private hands 6 weeks before 9/11, when Larry Silverstein took control, fired the security firm that had been handling since it opened in 1970, and hired Kroll Associates, an Israeli firm. So just as we had Israeli security at the different airports from which those planes allegedly departed, we had Israeli security at the World Trade Center. And in fact, there were a host of prominent figures who were adamant supporters of Israel involved in the transfer in the first place.
Now, on that point, I have just received a message from Dr. Kevin Barrett, who I think would actually really be great here, especially on the Israel element. Don't you think? So we're just
absolutely. Be great. Maybe you could have Kevin come on following me. That would be perfect.
Even better. We're going to have him on with you. And here he is coming on now. You know, I mean, this is something that I tend to excel at, is just, you know, just doing things on the fly. Now, we have Dr. Kevin Barrett now joining us. Kevin, welcome to the program.
Hey, good to be back with you, Vinny.
Now, what James was just saying, just to bring you up on it, was the amount of Israeli involvement, particularly security, involved with the World Trade Center. And we started off the conversation by talking about Snowden's recent leaked information detailing the possible use of mini and micro nukes used in the destruction of the World Trade Center. And I thought you'd probably want to weigh in on this one.
Sure, yeah, it's an interesting question. I think it's less important precisely how these demolitions were accomplished than that there were demolitions. And, of course, that's been proved seven ways from Sunday, but the world hasn't fully digested that information yet. So I think the most important thing to do is to kind of hammer at the fact that these three skyscrapers were clearly blown up with some form of high explosive. And then the question of what form of high explosive it was is really secondary. But there is, you know, interesting evidence for nuclear weapons at the Trade Center. For me, not being a nuclear scientist and not really being qualified to assess these various claims, especially the ones that rely on supposedly classified mini hydrogen nukes and things like that, that even the nuclear scientists don't know about. But the evidence that is interesting to me is the photographs that we recently found. Veterans Today published them, showing the molten granite bedrock under the towers, you know, after 9/11 when they excavated down there. Boy, something, it sure looks like something just outrageously hot. A tremendous amount of heat must have melted all that bedrock. If you just look at those photos, you have to ask yourself what possibly could have done this. And based on, you know, what we know about physics and so on, the obvious answer would be a nuclear weapon.
And according to NIST, it was probably the Flintstones that melted bedrock because they had such an awesome party.
Yeah, Fred and Barney did it.
Well, I don't know, Fred. I think he might have been a nuclear bomb, eh?
Maybe it was Bam Bam. Bam, bam, bam.
It's just like Bam Bam creates squibs. Bam, 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 bam.
that's Vinny, what those firefighters
expand,
are, isn't it?
Just to expand on the theme, Gordon has explained how the Israelis seem to come in possession of nuclear warheads by being given 35 howitzer nuclear warheads in the George W. Bush administration, took them back to Israel, refined them, and then brought them back into New York City by way of submarine, where they were their presence was detected by Russian satellites because of their gamma radiation, and then they were used to take out the Twin Towers. And, of course, in addition to the them having the power to blow apart those buildings, as I have been describing, and in addition to the U.S. geological dust samples, we have what turned out to be some 70,000 New Yorkers who have suffered from the kinds of ailments, multiple myeloma, esophageal, pancreatic cancer, lymphoma, and so forth, that are associated with exposure to ionizing radiation. So we know, you know, we have multiple evidential indicators, including, of course, these spectacular photographs of beneath where the towers had stood that seemed to indicate some massive, powerful explosions were detonated in that vicinity.
The one part that was very telling to me is the top of, I think it was World Trade Center 1, the one with the spire on the top, unlike Trade Center 2, how the top actually fell sideways and then just disappeared, right? It literally kind of poofed into virtually vaporized dust before it even hit the ground. Well, how was that? How was that even physically possible?
Well, actually, there are photographs of what appears to be the remnants of the tower itself, Vinny, so that, you know, it's a very fascinating puzzle to unpack, but it seems of the alternative theories, the only one that seems to hold together and provide the highest probability upon the available evidence is the use of mini or micro nukes, probably neutron bombs. But where the use of these very sophisticated weapons is very instructive because it rules out almost anyone except, you know, very sophisticated military sources, in particular the U.S. or, in this instance, Israel, because we had provided them to Israel, leaving out, of course, you know, the Chinese, the Russians, and so forth, who obviously had nothing to do with 9/11.
Kevin, do you believe that there's an Israeli hand in 9/11? And the question I would ask is why? Why would they do it?
Yes, I think there was an Israeli hand. In fact, I think 9/11 is best viewed as a kind of a hardline Zionist coup d'etat in the USA. And the question of why is pretty easy to answer, which is that Israel is in a very difficult position in terms of its long-term or even medium-term sustainability. Henry Kissinger famously said there wouldn't be any Israel 10 years from now. And that was a few years ago when he said it. He may have been exaggerating and trying to scaremonger and scare up some money from the usual funders. But I do think that the Israelis know that they're in a very bad situation. They've been conducting themselves so viciously since they genocidally occupied Palestine, slaughtered whole villages full of people, expelled most of the rest of the Palestinians, that nobody in the Middle East considers them a legitimate country. And they have a birth rate that's lower than that of the surrounding Arabs. And they basically feel that they're going to have to keep expanding and taking more and more territory in order to survive and stay in a permanent state of war. And of course, that's creating more and more opposition. So they feel like they need extraordinary measures to try to sustain Israel as an apartheid Jewish state. And I think 9/11 was one of those extraordinary measures. It was designed to create deep-seated hatred of Israel's Arab and Muslim enemies that would take the war to West, take the West to war, I mean, against the enemies of Israel for the next century. And that was the real, you know, it wasn't the New American Century. Project for a New American Century was a disguise. They just rewrote the clean break plan that was drafted by Benjamin Netanyahu in 1995-96. Netanyahu's people went and turned around and rewrote that document, which was about how to bust up the neighbors of Israel so Israel could survive. And they changed it to make it as though it were ostensibly to help the American empire last for another 100 years. But what it really is about is taking down Israel's enemies, changing the game in the Middle East, breaking these countries up into pieces, et cetera, et cetera. And that's what 9/11 was meant to do, was to essentially put these hardline Zionists in control in the U.S. and in the West and allow them to use the power of the U.S. and the West to wage endless war against the enemies of Israel.
So much like every other false flag throughout history that's been documented, it's pretty much a self-inflicted wound in order to blame a specific enemy, which is politically convenient to do, and also make a whole bunch of people rush into the recruiting stations to die for somebody else's money and power.
And we had further confirmation from Wesley Clark, who, after he returned from serving as Supreme Commander Allied Forces Europe, which is to say the commanding officer of NATO, he was had an encounter with a general in the Pentagon who told him that we were first going to plan to go to war with Iraq, which baffled him. He said, "Why?" And the general said, "Oh, I don't know." He says, "I guess we're just good at it." So Clark was baffled that we were even going to attack Iraq, which everyone knew had nothing to do with 9/11. When he returned months later and encountered the same general, he asked, "Are we still planning to attack Iraq?" And the general said, "Oh, sir, it's even worse now." He said, "I just received this memorandum from the Secretary of Defense that we're going to take out the governments of seven countries in the next 5 years." And again, he was dumbfounded about this. It was going to begin with Afghanistan, Iraq, and wind up with Syria and Iran, which, of course, is not an Arab country, but it was on the hit list. And he recollected a conversation he'd had years before with Paul Wolfowitz, who was Assistant Secretary of Defense at the time.
Wasn't he the former head of the World Bank as well?
Yeah, he would get that afterwards, about going into the Middle East and creating chaos so we could take it under control. But, of course, that wasn't the idea at all, as Kevin has been sketching. The idea was to deconstruct the modern Arab states and set them out from their secular governments, which had been holding them together, as had Saddam Hussein and Assad now is manfully struggling to keep his country together, because there would be an inevitable tension between the conflicting sects of Sunni, Shia, and Kurd. In the case of Iraq, for example, is a most obvious illustration. And it was therefore really to do the dirty work on behalf of Israel to advance its agenda to create the greater Israel dominating the entire region from the Tigris-Euphrates to the Nile.
Is Israel, of course, just a puppet themselves of the global bankers and whatnot, or is there actually a national agenda within the Israeli government, and they have that kind of power through the use of Mossad and other ruthless tactics in order to actually keep their influence going, or are they merely one piece on the chess board that the globalists are using? Now, before you answer that, I also wanted to clarify something here, because there's been a lot of anti-American sentiment in New Zealand, talking about mass surveillance. We have the NSA that is set up in our local kind of CIA variant called the GCSB building, and also the TPPA, the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, which is going to bind, I think, maybe nearly 10 or 11 countries or something like that into these massive corporate trade deals and agreements, which will in fact destroy New Zealand and all of those involved countries' abilities to write their own laws if it impedes the will of these globalist corporations. And I wanted to actually stress the point that it is not Americans or America that is actually doing this. It's merely being used as a vessel, a tool, a puppet, if you will, in order to basically project military and corporate dominance across the world and to blame the people of the United States for something the globalists are influencing. I think it's kind of missing the mark. Would you agree?
I think you're basically right, Vinny, and Kevin can add his additional reflections here, but it seems to me the Rothschilds bankers were equally eager to get into the Middle East, because there is an eschewing of usury in Islam, so that they'd never been able to get a foothold. I remember being struck when the rebel group in Libya out to overthrow Muammar Gaddafi, its first act was to found a new central bank. As soon as I heard that, I realized this was not at all as it was being portrayed to be. Kevin?
Yeah, getting back to Vinny's question, I think that there may be a kind of agenda among some of the banksters behind the New World Order to put the capital of their New World Order in Jerusalem. That's the thesis of Imran Hossein, who is probably the greatest Muslim scholar cum geopolitical analyst, and he argues that a kind of perversion of Judaism, you know, has taken this idea of the people going back to the promised land and has, you know, believes in taking back everything that God gave to the tribe and then taking over the world and putting the capital there. And he, Imran Hussein, thinks that that's actually going to happen. Many other scholars who've looked into this, including some Israelis, there's that Israeli journalist, Barry Chamish, who says that these are not Jews. These are sort of Donmei heretics, people who are followers of the false Messiah, Shabbatai Zeve, several centuries ago. He tried to lead a return to the promised land among Jews of the world, and he had a huge following. He was arrested. He converted to Islam to avoid the death penalty. And there's been all his followers converted as well. They pretended to be Muslims, and many of those people are now involved in running Turkey and its deep state, narcotics trafficking, finance. And it's said that the royal family of Saudi Arabia may also be Donmei Jews. And so these people are actually not really Jews, though. They're Satanists. They have sexual orgies as their religious rituals and conduct human sacrifices. According to Barry Chamish, the Israeli investigative reporter, they took over the Rothschild family, took over Freemasonry, the Illuminati, et cetera, et cetera, in the late 18th century, and consolidated power in global finance. And according to Imran Hussein, these are the people who want to put the new world capital in Jerusalem. And he says to do it, they're going to create a world war. Out of that world war, they hope that Israel will be kind of the last power standing. They'll have control over the energy resources of the Middle East, and they will overtly establish a kind of a world capital or a new hegemon in greater Israel, which, of course, will be Nile to Euphrates Israel, not the Israel of today. Now, whether or not all of this is true, clearly there are people in Israel, Zionists, who want this and who believe in it. It seems that many of the founding fathers of Zionism were planning on, you know, taking all of Eretz Israel, greater Israel, meaning Nile to the Euphrates, and totally dominating the Middle East and perhaps the world. So, yeah, I think that there is an intersection between a certain agenda of at least some of these globalist banksters and the state of Israel.
And how does that actually make you feel as a follower of Islam personally? I mean, do you feel like your religion's under attack or what?
Well, yeah, not just my religion, but if indeed this is all true, that if there's actually a kind of a cosmic struggle of good versus evil going on. It sounds goofy and mythological, and, you know, it's not the kind of thing that secular intellectuals these days like to even entertain. But I think that actually just closely observing what's going on in the world, as people like Imran Hussein do, can convince you that this may be the case, that the Zionist movement has been so mendacious and so vicious and so powerful and so good at disguising its power, pretending to be the victim while it's actually the victimizer. There is something really creepy and satanic about this. You know, Islam is about submission to God, and everybody who submits to God is a Muslim with a small M. That would include Christians, Jews, even some Hindus and Buddhists and Native American and whoever else. And so if indeed the Holy Land is under occupation by Satanists, this as a Muslim and, you know, as Christians and everybody else who cares about goodness should be upset about this. And obviously it's going to lead to trouble, that this Holy Land has been taken over by people who are this nasty and deceptive and satanic. That can't be good, you know, whatever your nominal religion.
It matters not whether or not you believe in Satanism or Islam. The point is there are people out there who do believe it. And they will act, and those actions will affect you. Now, that's whether or not they are acting with good intentions or with good actions. And I'm sure that in a lot of ways, good intentions and good actions aren't necessarily the exact same thing.
Yeah, that's true. I think that there are plenty of people, including Zionists and Israelis, who have good intentions within their old worldview. And indeed, you know, the Americans who marched off into Iraq and slaughtered hundreds of thousands of people, maybe over a million in this latest war, probably had good intentions in many cases. They thought they were bringing freedom and democracy to Iraq. And the Nazis, who killed so many people, however many the total number and whatever ethnicity and whatever method of execution they may have used, which Jim, I'm sure, would have a lot to say about, those people probably had good intentions within their own worldview as well. Most people do, perhaps even the Satanists. You know, I think a lot of Satanists think that Satan is the liberator and, you know, God is the tyrant. So within people's own worldviews, they tend to find some way of approving of their own actions.
Now, I'm sorry, guys, we're going to have to quickly take a break here. Are you both free for the next 25 minutes or so to do one more segment?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Sure.
Okay. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com. It's a listener-supported broadcast, so if you go there and donate or start to subscribe regularly for $5 a month, we'd really appreciate it, and allows us to bring you radio like this. Damn, this is awesome. We'll be right back. And welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the final segment of the Vinnie Eastwood Show. It's a bit of an impromptu broadcast today. We have Professor James Fetzer and... wait a second. Kevin, aren't you a professor too?
Well, I was a professor at Kaplan University for a while. I was a lecturer at UW-Madison, and I've had various titles at various higher education institutions. So you can call me professor if it pleases you.
All right. Well, you tend to profess things. It's sort of come with the job. Okay.
Okay, I'll profess. I'll profess to profess.
I'll confess to professing. Okay. Anyway, Jim, you were saying something about this religious aspect.
Yeah, you want to bear in mind that Barack Obama encountered a problem with the public when he wanted to lob cruise missiles into Syria in response for the gas attacks, which were being assigned to this Syrian government, but in fact came from the rebels. Prince Bandar of Saudi Arabia may well have been the supplier in that instance. But the American public was outraged, even if they had come from Assad, that Obama was going to get us involved in yet another war. The cruise missiles would have killed many more people than the gas purportedly had. It would have been another violation of a nation's sovereignty, in this instance, Syria. And by a ratio of on the order of 99-1, the American people said absolutely not, no, and it was defeated. Therefore, they had a marketing problem of how to advance the agenda of finishing off Syria and then before turning to Iran, which led to the inspired concoction of the Islamic State, which really is a merge of Al-Qaeda and other efforts together with support from the U.S., Israel, and Saudi Arabia. So we now have this new menace, which is being used to justify American attacks, even in Syria, allegedly to stop ISIS. But the fact of the matter is, as Alan Zabrowski has observed, we're bombing the infrastructure of Syria, including grain silos, oil refineries, bridges, and the like, which are intended to leave him far weaker than he was absent those attacks. Victoria Nuland, on a recent interview on national television, admitted we were not there to stop ISIS. We were there to undermine Assad. We have a U.S. general who, by the name of Valali, who's actually advising them. The EU ambassador to Iraq admits the EU is buying oil from ISIS. The U.S. is spending $200 million every week, both supporting and attacking ISIS, meaning we're feigning at least to be attacking it, but really seeking to undermine Assad, where most tellingly this whole Khorasan group was invented out of thin air to pose some imminent threat to the United States. I'm sure Kevin was just as baffled as I when it first made its entry, with Obama solemnly intoning that we have this imminent threat. It's rather clear that this was a way to circumvent the United Nations Charter, which dictates that one country cannot attack another unless it has approval of the Security Council, with the sole exception that it confronts an imminent threat. So out of thin air, they spun up the Khorasan group to be an imminent threat to justify what we're doing, even though it's in violation of the UN Charter. And
well, what I seem to happen here is that they make these rules and they build in loopholes, kind of like the way the Obama administration built in loopholes for the the insurance companies, the health insurance companies, when passing Obamacare. Incidentally, Obamacare was written by You guessed it, the insurance companies. And it's this exact same kind of cynical, nihilistic scumbaggery process by which they can more or less break their own laws ad infinitum and never be charged for them, because even if they did break a law and get caught for it, they also have the ability to change laws retroactively to make breaking the law legal and then continue to break it anyway.
It's absurd. You know, if anyone just listening to what you said would say, that's preposterous. You know, no one could make that up. But in fact, that's been what has happened with the recent history of the United States. It's deplorable. It's appalling. I have never been more ashamed of the United States than when it demonstrates hypocrisy of the degree to which it's displaying it today. Duplicity, deception, lies, lies, lies. We're getting nothing but lies. I mean, from Sandy Hook and the Boston bombing to the Ebola hoax to what's going on in Africa to the Ukraine and the Middle East. I mean, it's all a pack of lies. It's absolutely unbelievable. You can't get any truth from the government anymore at all. And a recent weakening of the Smith-Mundt Act, of which you may have never heard, but it was a legislation from 1948 that precluded the use of propaganda techniques by the American government on the American people, was vitiated by the National Defense Appropriations Act of 2013, which means now there's no holds barred on spreading false information and deliberately deceiving the American people about domestic or foreign affairs.
Like Jim Dean says, you can't make this stuff up, but they can. You know, it was Karl Rove who lashed out at the reality-based community, said, "We're an empire now. We create our own reality. And while you reality-based idiots are out there trying to figure out what we've done, we're going to be way out ahead of you, creating new realities. And that's the way it's going to play out from now on. You know, we're history's actors, and you're just going to be trying to figure out what we do."
This reminds me exactly of what I think it was Mark Twain who said, that the problem with fiction is that it has to make sense. Nonfiction doesn't.
Yeah, it makes less and less all the time.
He made a lot of astute observation, including that it's easier to fool a person than to convince him that he has been fooled, which is part of the problem with trying to reveal the deceptions of 9/11, Sandy Hook, Boston bombing, what's going on in the Ukraine and the Middle East.
I wanted to make a point here about the last century in America. You've gone from 10% growth in the economy per year under a non-central banking cartel to progressive taxation and a private central bank, and you've gone from being the most intelligent, literate, morally backboned citizenry in the history of the world to the laziest, dumbest, most capitulating human trash that has ever existed. And this is the deliberate agenda of a evil group of scumbags who know that all the goodness that was America needed to be destroyed in order for them to rule it.
I wish
That's
I could
right.
disagree with
The American middle class
you.
Was their biggest obstacle in the path of the New World Order.
That's right. So you had to vitiate the middle class, and NAFTA and the WTO did a pretty good job of that. But you're absolutely correct, Vinny. In the most recent ranking of economic freedom, as recently as 2000, the United States stood second in economic freedom here, which is a function of the rule of law and of the maintenance of property rights and freedom from corruption. We've now sunk. We are 12th, tied with the UK in only a few years, and it's got all to do with this loss in property rights, freedom, corruption, and the control of government spending. We have lost the rule of law, and why this is so terribly important is that economic freedom is really a close facsimile of what's known as effective freedom, meaning, you know, freedom. Everyone has the right to sleep under bridges and eat from garbage cans if they want. But effective freedom is what you can do with the resources at your disposal. The reason the rich are actually freer than the poor is because they have more effective freedom. They have more resources to buy yachts, sail the world, you know, travel, whatever, live a certain lifestyle, buy expensive automobiles. So this diminution in economic freedom, although most Americans wouldn't grasp the concept at all, really is a very serious matter. And the fact is that the loss of the rule of law has gone so far that we now have even a recent article from the Washington Post about agencies, and these include agencies like police agencies, the FBI and the DEA, are conducting raids on homes and taking possession of property. I have a good friend who is a former top psychiatric consultant to the FBI, of all people, a prominent psychiatrist in Washington, D.C., who was targeted by the DEA. They took his three automobiles, his three computers. They froze his bank account, allegedly because he had $100,000 there from dealing drugs. Well, he wasn't a drug dealer. He had that for medical equipment. But it turns out the way the law is written now, they can appropriate all of your possessions with no due process whatsoever, and you have to go to court to prove that you own them to regain control of them. Ironically, in his case, he was notified a year later that he had received a speeding ticket from Montgomery County for one of the vehicles the DEA had appropriated, which they'd been using to joyride, a ticket for $80. I mean, talk about adding insult to injury for vehicles that they'd taken possession of a year before.
Now, the reason why I made that analysis of that the last century being the fall of America, I believe, comes down to one man, and one man only, who triggered it all and allowed this to happen, Edward Bernays, the man who literally created propaganda and public relations. And if you have a look at anything that the United States government does today, it is all propaganda, it is all public relations, none of which would have been possible or as effective without that man.
Well, that's right. You know, a more accurate term for it is mind control. Public relations is really a euphemism. What it's about is affecting people's thought and behavior below the level of consciousness. And that's evil. You know, it's like if I try to convince you to do something or believe something, if I engage you rationally and consciously and we debate it, that's fine. But if I use special techniques to try to implant things into your mind that you're not aware are there, that will govern your thoughts and behavior, that's evil. That's mind control. And that's what Bernays invented, using the discovery of the unconscious by Uncle Sigmund Freud to do that. And today it's so out of control. People are walking around, you know, like brainwashed lemmings. They don't understand why it is that the thought of what may have really happened on 9/11, even looking into that question, generates so much fear. Well, they had something implanted deep in their minds by the traumatic, the mind control event of 9/11. Same thing with the Nazi Holocaust. Even talking about what did and didn't happen during the Nazi Holocaust sends spasms of fear up and down the spine of most people for reasons that are completely unconscious. They couldn't possibly articulate what's going on in their own minds. And these are just a couple of examples. Actually, people's entire way of life and their consciousness, their actions are all being governed by these mind controllers. So, yeah, really, Bernays created puppet strings to the unconscious minds of the mass public and greatly degraded humanity and degraded the human soul.
I do believe this is absolutely the case, and I think it's evidenced by the fact that most people think Bernays is some form of condiment that you put on a sandwich with lettuce.
Well, that sounds tasty. You could probably put an ad with a really delicious-looking sandwich and convince me to eat some Bernays on it, you know?
I mean, you know, what could go wrong?
Bernays brand sandwich spread.
Coincidentally, I'm in contact with Gordon because I've been having trouble getting onto Veterans Today, and someone had written me and that how they'd been unable to make access, so I asked him about it, and it turns out that Veterans Today has been hacked because of an article Gordon wrote exposing about Ebola and the whole hoax involved here, and that pretending that Homeland Security hasn't trained thousands in bioterrorist seminars costing billions of dollars explain you can only control Ebola at level 3 quarantine. You can't do it with duct tape and paper jammies. And how we have a story now about what you do when someone with Ebola throws up on you as a healthcare worker. You leave work, get on a plane for Cleveland. He's saying an estimated 5,000 Americans have been exposed already. But, you know, the whole thing is simply completely ridiculous.
I'm getting sick of this whole. I'm getting sick of this whole endless pandemic thing. You know, it's bird flu, dog flu, camel flu, Ebola. I mean, what's going to be next? And that's basically it. When it comes out, it's a seasonal thing, and there's some kind of disease. Incidentally, every single disease that had basically ever been classified as a global pandemic winds up having some kind of Department of Defense contract or patent on it or whatever. And then incidentally, the Department of Defense, who owns a huge chunk of most of the major pharmaceutical companies or whatever, at the very least in some way is influencing and controlling them, winds up getting a whole lot of money as all these stupid people go out and rush to get their vaccines, which are full of deadly chemicals that they don't even know the names of because there aren't even any ingredients on the frickin' packets.
So you're not lining up to get the Ebola vaccine, Vinny?
I would rather line up to an execution stand.
Yeah, well, that may be what you're doing if you get the Ebola vaccine. It may be the Ebola is in the vaccine. I mean, the Ebola was first discovered in Africa in the 1970s. Now, in the intervening decades, and we've had quite a few of them up until now, it has not become a major problem, even though they're standards of hygiene and sanitation are grossly inferior to what we experience here in the Western nations. I mean, there's something here that just doesn't add up. And it's pretty clear that this is intended to instill fear into the American people, possibly as a potential justification for imposing martial law. They've been looking for something to do this for a long time, it seems to me, and this may be one more gambit to see if the American people will fall for it.
I think they're just trying to keep the pot boiling. It's the politics of fear. You know, that BBC documentary, The Power of Nightmares, got it right. The politicians used to rule using hope, telling you that vote for us and you'll have a better life. Now there's no more hope for a better life, so they're ruling with fear. 9/11 was the big event of this new age of the politics of fear. But to get 9/11, they had to do some false flags before that, African embassy bombings, USS Cole. And then to keep the pot boiling after 9/11, they had to do some more false flags. And along with the false flags, they come up with some disease scare every year or two. Like you said, Vinny, it was the bird flu, and then it was this, it was that, now it's Ebola. I don't think that Ebola is going to be capable of generating any major epidemic. Probably thousands of times more people will die of flu this year than will die of Ebola. But hey, it's sexy. People are bleeding out every orifice. That's great. Yeah, vomiting, projectile vomiting and bleeding out every orifice. This makes wonderful fear propaganda. So I think they're just trying to keep the propaganda pot boiling.
I saw a great picture the other day that says, what's the difference between love and herpes? Herpes is forever.
Well, Gordon is even saying that the disease is not actually communicable. But, you know, Vinny, you were speaking of dismay with your PM. What did you think about David Cameron announcing that 9/11 truthers and 7/7 critics should be handled the same way, dealt with as harshly as ISIS? I mean, what's he planning to do?
That was hilarious.
It's unreal.
I thought that he should be on the Vinny Eastwood show.
So people who are opposed to government terrorism are the worst kind of terrorists. Just like the terrorists that the government funds.
I mean, we're cutting people's heads off.
Did I miss something?
Kevin and I have this great friend in the UK by the name of Nick Kohlerstrom, who actually, recognizing that he was both a 9/11 truther, a critic of 7/7, he's actually published the leading book on entitled Terror on the Tube, now in its fourth edition, exposing the hoax that was 7/7. He took himself down to Scotland Yard and said he wanted to report terrorism and that he had a bit of evidence. He brought a copy of his book along to Scotland Yard. They refused to arrest him, but I thought it was a marvelous, you know, exposure of the absurd position adopted by the PM of the UK.
I'm a nonviolent extremist. Please arrest me before I commit nonviolent extremism again.
Well, it's as though Cameron doesn't understand the difference between thought and action. I mean, this is as absurd as it gets.
Oh, dear God, he's nonviolent. Boom!
Vinny, is it that bad down in your neck of the woods? I mean,
what's been happening now? The Prime Minister's been who used to work for Merrill Lynch and has shares and still has shares in the Bank of America, which New Zealand still loans money off, mind you, has been saying that there's Al Qaeda terrorists in New Zealand and all sorts of other stuff. He's passed draconian surveillance legislation amid massive uproar to the country, and everybody is like, well, actually, it violates this law and that law and that law and that law and that law in order to pass that one law. And so he goes, well, bugger it, I'll just do it anyway, and then change all the laws retroactively. So it basically, what I've come to conclude is that, and I also want to reference back to my analysis of America in the last 100 years and its fall and descent, it is not just you guys. my country is always has also turned into fat, lazy, unthinking, unsuspicious, easily manipulated, herdable sheep, which is even worse considering there's like 40 million sheep in this country and 4 million people. One could argue that there's actually 44 million sheep.
Is it something in the water, Vinny? You know, Lancet.
We do have fluoride.
Lancet has finally declared that fluoride actually is a neurotoxin. In areas where the water is heavily fluoridated, the children lose, you know, appreciable IQ points as a consequence. So it may be your country has been massively fluoridated for so long, it's finally taking its toll.
If a man gets shot by the police and then runs into a burning house and then inhales smoke and then gets stabbed by somebody else who's in that burning house and then gets a giant air conditioning unit fall through the floor and land on him, what killed him? All right. See, there's the argument saying that fluoride's the result of the vanishing IQ. In actual fact, everything is. There's so many influential factors. I mean, and let's not underestimate, again, the power of the media through which basically fluoride would have never been justified, because if you have a media that does things like, I don't know, fact check anything that they say before they actually say it, or maybe check up on what a politician's statement is before reporting it mindlessly, word for word, right? If they were to do any of that, if there was any such a thing as journalism truly in the mainstream media, all of these things that we talk about, all of these things that we are concerned about, would not be a concern. The only reason why corruption is allowed to grow is because people are not concerned about it, and thus it can continue to grow exponentially. Corruption's kind of like cancer. It has an exponential growth curve, and it will only die once it kills the host, or once the host kills it.
Jeez, that sounds like nonviolent extremist talk there, Vinny.
Killing corruption is not killing a human being. It is not hurting a person. It is simply exposing that which others do not wish to be seen. And as I think it was Orwell that said, if you, a journalist's job is to report that which people don't want you to report. Everything else is public relations, which, as Kevin so eloquently stated before, is mind control.
Well, geez, Vinny, you know, your brand of nonviolent extremism is probably the worst. I mean, it is just like ISIS, because you're a nonviolent humor extremist, and you make people laugh their heads off.
Well, you know, you got to look on the lighter side of genocide, and I think that there is actually this element here there where wars only happen and keep going when people lose their sense of humor about it. All right. Basically, that's about the end of it. And if you think about the Israel-Palestine conflict, for interest, how many jokes do you reckon are coming out about that? Nothing.
The lighter side of the Israel-Palestine conflict. That sounds like a good idea for a book.
Exactly. I came up with a couple of jokes. I'll share you my Israeli jokes, and then we've unfortunately, I've got to go. I've got about 2 minutes before my next broadcast comes up with the Man Talk project. But what I wanted to say was, why are Israelis suspicious of chickpeas? Because they could be working for Hamas. And also, this is the reason why you don't take Israelis out for Turkish kebabs, because they'll shoot at the Hamas. And how do Israeli tank crews greet Palestinian children? By saying shalom. Mm.
Shalom indeed.
Yeah, that's serious nonviolent humor extremism there, Vinny. But
hey, it may be serious, but it's definitely not very Assad.
I love the lighter side of genocide.
Hey, you know, just because we're being enslaved and ruthlessly criminally dominated by the worst human trash that have ever existed on the planet Earth doesn't mean we can't have a few laughs about it, eh? Otherwise, the terrorists win.
I think laughter can transmit Ebola, Vinny. Yeah. You have to be careful.
Well, I think you can transmit it through radio waves or something like that.
Oh, God, turn your radio off! Now!
In fact, I'm just going to give you Ebola now, ladies and gentlemen. Ebola! Ebola! There we go. You've all now got it. Thank you very much, Jim.
Our pleasure.
And thank you very much, Kevin.
Thank you, Vinny. I'm not bleeding out all of my orifices yet, but I think the ears are starting to itch.
Just wait. you know, it's a slow thing. It grows on you like a fungus or something of that nature, which is why I'm capable of transmitting it through the media, because I'm such a fungi. Thank you very much, and thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for listening to The Vinny Eastwood Show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. There's a listener-supported broadcast, so if you want to make sure that everybody's having a huge laugh and whatever while they're being ruthlessly criminally exterminated by ruthless criminal scum, then please go to thevinnyeastwoodshow.com and donate or subscribe for $5 a month today. Thank you for listening, and we'll see you again sometime.